Hello there, everyone, and welcome to episode 8 of Psyched to Be With You with my very special guest, Oksan Boh. This was a great conversation. I do just want to let you know, for those that maybe like to listen in family-friendly spaces, we do talk about sex robots at one point, so there's a little bit of mention of that. It's not necessarily explicit, but just so you know. So we all talk about robots and ethics and in video games. We go on some great tangents about horror. Yeah, this was just a wild, putting the world to rights conversation. I really enjoyed it. I hope you do too. Enjoy the episode. It was a banger. Hello, everyone, and welcome back to episode 8 of Psyched to Be With You. We are back with what is going to be another absolutely class episode. I am hyped. I hope you are as well. All that remains for me to do is pass over to you, my very special guest. If you could please tell us who you are and what you do and why you're doing it.
Really great questions. So hi, my name is Oksan Boh. I'm a researcher at the Institute for Ethics and Artificial Intelligence at the Technical University of Munich. And that's where I do my PhD as well. So I do my PhD in social robotics, but I have a master's in cyber psychology, where I studied video game psychology. And I do a lot of parallel researches linked to AI ethics, so artificial intelligence ethics. That's my specialty lately, but I keep video game psychology in my heart. We were talking about having a favorite child. Might be one of the favorites for sure. Wow. And also I'm French, so apologize for my English when it gets weird.
I was gonna say we've had some great accents on the show. This isn't just another one that really adds to the flavor of the podcast alongside my quite droll Scouse accent up here in the northwest of England. Firstly, I just want to say, for anyone who was unsure by any of that, Oksan is just incredibly talented, I think, is what we can draw from all those knowledge bases. So, as you sort of said, you cover a wide range of things, but what have you been looking at recently? Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Of course. So, right now, I am on 4 different specific topics. The first one for my PhD research is social robotics and the ethics of social robotics. So, soon there will be robots in your homes, and actually, guess what? There is already robots in your homes. Yeah, you can consider Alexa, for example, as a robot.
You may well Alexa be listening to this podcast on a robot right now.
Exactly. Who knows? Siri is a robot. So anyway, you can see that social robots are already there. They're not embodied yet, even though probably most of us have seen this new Amazon little robot running around that they're ready to put on the market. And that's what I study. And it goes from this conversational artificial intelligence to as far as sex robots. Oh. So that's a really wide field of research. I study mainly the interaction, the impact of this interaction with the human, and how to prevent harm, how to manage risks. On the other side, we're doing multiple other research. One is on education, higher education in Senegal and the digitalization of it, and how we can help find solutions to the problematics that they had to face during COVID. That's a project that is almost done. So I'm really interested in education as well. Looking at COVID and technologies, and therefore technology acceptance during COVID, depending on cultural things or ethical things, whatever, in different countries. And also explainability and accountability. So when you talk about explainability in AI, it means, do you understand what the AI does? And if yes, where does the accountability start, for you or for the company? And that's also research we're starting right now. So we're not 100% really precise on what's the research question yet. But that is a big field, and that is a bit, yeah, that's a big share of a big cake that we need to start looking at. I'm not sure I forgot any other. Oh, and video games and diversity, obviously. That's another research field that I'm back in, if we can say. Was in, left, came back. And at this point, we're building drafts with a lot of other researchers, really nice ones, but I won't tease too much of this. But yeah, soon maybe you'll see something cool coming out.
Okay, so, I mean, I've had a few guests where I've had to ask this, but I'm like, how? How are you doing all that? How are you doing all these things that sound so important? Does not compute? Why, it's...
I guess you have to be a bit hyperactive and also get a bit bored of things at some point that you have to change, and then you can get back to a topic. I'm not sure. Honestly, if it's fun, I'm just saying yes, and I do it. And at the end of the day, usually it works. Usually I have time.
I mean, I've said this before on the show, but like, I feel like my PhD so far has been like, I did the tutorial, and like I started the game, and then I've just done nothing but side quests. So I feel like, you know, like, you're just like, oh, people want me to do fun and cool things, let's go do that. And then like 40 hours have passed, and you're like, wait a minute, I'm going to be a bit OP for the main quest now. Whoops-a-daisy.
That's exactly what's happening. But I got the chance to be paid for some of those other research. So actually, my PhD is not finance per se. So my PhD research is not, it is still the main quest. But to get fundings, I have to do some of the side quests. So there is
like
that.
Like an actual
well.
Game, you got to do the side quest to exactly. Get the goods for the main quest. See, life is a game. I've always said that.
Exactly, gamification of academia. Here you go.
Oh, let's not get started on ResearchGate. Gamification statistics. Oh,
fair enough.
Yeah,
I love ResearchGate, though. I love the little accomplishment, the little trophies they give you. And this is such a gamification of publications. I love it.
I forget what it is. Badges.
You have to love the game.
Badges, leaderboards, and something else. I forget what the third one is.
Yeah, they give you stats every week, and then they give you trophies when you get to a certain amount of readings in a week or stuff like that. I have to love it.
Nice.
I'm always happy when I receive a trophy. It works on me.
Fair. I mean, they've got to work, otherwise they wouldn't do it, right?
Exactly.
So let's just tease into a little bit of social robotics. You kind of touched onto the whole breadth of spectrum there, the ethics. I feel like I'm a big sci-fi nerd. I love Dystopian as well. There's a big whole kind of, I feel like everyone has seen like at least like that episode of Futurama, like don't start just like smooching with robots. There's, you know, the episode of Black Mirror with the robot dogs and the robot bees. There's another episode of Black Mirror. How close or far away are we from any of those things happening?
So far, at least when it comes to singularity and all that kind of stuff, right? We're so far from the worst case scenario that we see in sci-fi. Now, about the automated dogs and automated bees, I'm not sure how far we are, but I know that I'm happy to be in Europe because of the regulations coming up and because of the protection we have against it. Legally speaking, so not just morally speaking, but actually legally speaking. I don't know if you've seen, but the EU Parliament is reviewing a law proposed by the EU Commission at the moment that is called the Artificial Intelligence Act. And in there is some strong regulations linked to surveillance and that kind of things. So we're happy with that, at least I am, especially when I'm thinking about the bees, the episode about the bees, where they, if I remember well, they're just like looking at everyone at all time and things like that. I've seen a TV show where everyone was followed as well by a little AI thing, and basically no crime was happening anymore in the society. It's like, wow, I understand how it works. I just don't want it to happen, you know?
You obviously also like the classic, you know, 1984 George Orwell kind of example of like, you know, and then added on that, you kind of get, and I'm just tying it with movie references and book references, but like, you know, who's watching The Watchmen? Like, who's then surveilling the AI? Are they going to be the elite that sidestep the AI and can still do what they want? So it's a little bit yikes, a little bit scary.
I think I see why it can be scary. Personally, I am not scared because I do trust EU And those laws are illegal. I am sorry. But I mean, you know, also GDPR initially was just EU, and a lot of countries have adopted similar regulations, literally building officially on GDPR. So I'm kind of hoping that the AI Act will be the same, you know. I know that some countries are already moving around to do some more ethics laws and not just recommendations. Because big difference, right? Mm-hmm. If you get a law, then you can get into court and actually do something if you do not follow the law. But yeah, anyway, I'm not afraid. I feel like I would be happy to have little robots roaming around as long as I'm sure where my data are going and how they're being used and processed.
Okay. So, I mean, you talk about sort of ethics of like social robotics. I mean, does that overlap at all with, because you know, to plug my own podcast, I think it was episode 3 with Dr. Celeste San Giorgio, we were talking about like AI in like psychology, and like mm-hmm. related to like app related treatments and things like that. Have you got any thoughts or feelings around like sort of like AI and ethics in like the way humans interact with them, particularly around like health data and things like
that? Of course, especially for mental health, to be fair. We can still talk about care robots, right? That's a categorization of the social robots. Care robots can be extremely helpful in hospitals to support staff, because as COVID has shown, unfortunately, and fortunately for the future, unfortunately for us now, but good for what's to come next, staff need help. Hospital staffs are just not enough. They can do their best. It's never going to be enough. And unless a lot of systems are rethought, we will need to cope. And AI can be a solution to help coping as a support for the carers. There is different things existing or being tested or being developed at the moment in that way. One would be robots to help support physically patients. Because that might seem stupid, but a lot of the nurses have to carry a lot of weight of the patients because they can't walk properly anymore. Well, that's super important because we're breaking the back of our nurses, literally. And those robots could do that and avoid a lot of injuries in the staff. On the other hand, you also have mental health robots, and that's where I wanted to go with that as well. I'm thinking of kids on the autistic spectrum and their problematics with interacting with others. Actually, some robots have been developed in a certain way to help them and to help them interact first with the robot that they can trust, and they can predict the behavior, therefore will be more at ease with. And then the robot motivates them to go speak with other people, with actual humans. And I think this is extremely positive. That kind of use of robotics and AI is extremely positive in my views.
Okay, I don't want to put any blushes on anyone's cheeks, but I do feel obliged to ask about the sex robots. Not a personal kind of like ooh la la, kind of like that sort of school.
Is it your
brand.
Personal interest?
As someone that knows, like, what's the stance on that? Like, where's that at? Like, is that surely ethically questionable?
Well, yes, it is ethically questionable, but at the moment, my main issue with that is that there is no research, right? So a lot of people have opinions, good for them. Opinions are not data. So I've heard arguments on all sides. So first I'll give you a bit of an overview of where we're at with that, right? With the sex robots. Right now, the best sex robots you can have only the face that is mobile. So it's basically a doll with a face that moves and a few settings that you can add, such as talk a certain way or asks a certain amount of things, etc. So it is not at all as developed as people might think. I don't know if you've seen the movie AI from Spielberg, was it? I think it was Spielberg.
Yeah, I feel like and I that's, have, but...
that's an old movie where you follow a little boy and in his adventure in a world, dystopian world, where androids are everywhere. And there is sex robots. There is sex androids. And that's basically what I go back to in my mind when I think about sex robots, that how far are we from this? And so far. So far. Now, is there a market for it? Yes, there is. Because sex makes money. but also, is there a market for it to be used in mental health, for example, or in healthcare? And yes, there is, because a lot of angles that people usually don't consider when we talk about sexuality is disabled people, for example, people with mental defects, people that have issues interacting with other humans. All those people, they still have needs, whether they have limitations or not. And I think in this context, those robots could be amazing. Now, as a recreational thing, my personal views is that I don't really mind. At the moment, the technology doesn't scare me because it is, I mean, Alexa is the best conversational AI we have at the moment. Mm-hmm. So you can imagine that it's not that far, right? It's not that big. As a cyber psychologist now, my idea is where is the future of this relationship going? Because Japan, for example, was planning on developing a robot wife. And the robot wife would cook and would clean and would also be a sex robot. And would probably have some features in her conversation building towards love. And having the human in front of her build towards, or in front of it, build towards love. And I think that's where we need to have limitations put up. Because we don't know what will be the effect of that. And that's my question. That's my main question. And how do we regulate that? How do we make sure that the human can use the robot without going into a bad situation for themselves?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if you've seen it, but there's a TV show called Humans. It was on Channel 4 a few years ago. But there was a lot of this kind of thing addressed, like, more towards sentience and sentient androids, which I feel like is the dystopian kind of storyline whenever robots are involved. But I think what you're kind of getting at there is that it's one thing to say, yeah, we're going to use a robot for this purpose X, Y, and Z. But I mean, as humans, like, we don't really even understand, like, love, scientifically speaking. I'm not dissing all your poets or musicians out there, right? But, like, scientifically, we don't really get it. So to try and consider, like, computing in such a way, that type of feeling and thoughts and responses would be very sort of grey.
And also, I'm not sure it is possible, to be fair, because if we don't know how it works, how can we replicate it? So the best at this point you could get, I would guess, is a robot that uses love speech, which is really different from a robot that loves, right? So I think we're extremely far from robots with emotions, talking about sentience, talking about singularity, that kind of thing. I don't see that. That's what I'm saying. I don't see that happening anytime soon. I don't even see that happening. That's it. But that's my views. And I know a lot of people disagree with me. But yeah, when it comes to relationship with social robots, we will develop emotions because we're humans and we anthropomorphize. Therefore, we consider that something, even if it's not living, is living in a way. We give it an attachment. Even objects that don't have answers, you know, that are not inanimate object. Here's the word I was looking for, inanimate object. So I'm not even talking about smartphones or anything that can give you a feedback in a way.
Well, I mean, like, sentimentality is huge, isn't it? I mean, you know, if you ever watch any of these, or you catch, like, any of my streams, you see a big, like, bunch of stuff behind me on shelves. Like, so many of those things are gifts from people that, the gift in itself is inanimate, but I feel a great emotional connection to those things.
Exactly.
And when you begin to put that on things that can respond and maybe begin to enhance those feelings or reinforce those feelings, that's maybe a bit interesting.
Exactly. And we know that as humans, most of our population will develop at least attachment towards robots. So my question is, what's up next? Okay, we'll have the attachment. I'm happy with this because this will allow, basically the trust will be first probably, and then you will have the attachment. I'm not against it. We've had attachment for objects for forever. And we all remember Tamagotchis, probably.
Oh, Tamagotchis.
That was in our time. I guess we're about the same age. So,
for those that don't know, Tamagotchis were kind of like, I mean, I think you can essentially get an app equivalent now, but it was a little beep-boop, beep-boppy thing, a little LED, well, not even LED, like 8-bit screen, that you had to have under bright light to see it, but it was a little pet that you raised, quote unquote. You had to feed it and clean up its poop and put it to bed. But like, if you didn't feed it for like a couple of hours, like it died. And like, I know so many children through like the 90s and noughties that were just so emotionally distraught by the fact that they forgot to feed the Tamagotchi.
And it died, okay? It died. And that was horrible.
Like, I remember the graphic really clear. It was like just a little tombstone with RIP on. And then it was like, well, you can start again.
And that was already a second generation we had, the one that can start again. Because prior to that, you could not start again, mm-hmm. which means you had a Tamagotchi. And if it died, that was on you. That was it. Your pet is dead. Yeah. And that was kind of what it was pictured as. It was the virtual pet, right? That was kind of the selling point of it. So for parents who didn't want to have pets for their children, but still wanted them to stop whining about it, they would get them Tamagotchis. And there is actually an effect in the human-computer, human-robot interaction literature that is called the Tamagotchi effect. And that's the situation where you do want to care for this thing. You do love it. Whether you want it or not, you have attachment, you have affection. Is it true love? Who knows? As you said, we cannot really quantify love at this point scientifically. But you have this behavior of someone that loves the object. And that was, I mean, I'm 26 and I was probably 10 when those stuff were around. So that was 16 years ago about. So you can imagine that today behaviors are not changing when it comes to that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. Maybe we have more options, so maybe we have different scripts with those. But in the end, real problematic, if we can say, it's not a real problem, but a research problematic, is what happens because of this attachment? What is the consequence on the human? I think it can be positive, because if you trust your robot, then maybe they can teach you something, or it can teach you something. It can help you, like it's doing with the autistic kids. You know, there is a lot of positive things coming out of it. But we still need to be careful. As long as we don't have data proving that it's safe, for me, it could be harmful. Mm-hmm.
I want to dial back a moment. I feel bad because I'm be like, let's talk about the sex robots again. But like, just we'll curtail the blue discussion after this. Because you mentioned an interesting thing about disability. And I don't like to be sensationalist, quote unquote, on the podcast, you know. Mm-hmm. But I remember not so long ago, there was an article in a newspaper over here in the UK about a disabled man who was going to lose his prescription for escort services or for sexual interactions. And there was a big uproar, admittedly, through like a psychologist, forensic psychologist I like, Dr. Jessica Taylor, who is a self-quoted radical feminist. I've read her book, Why Women Are Blamed for Everything, who was like, why are people upset about this? Like, no one is entitled to another person's body. Like, no one is entitled to, like, sex with another human. You're entitled to feel cared for, like, in, you know, Maslow's hierarchy of needs. But, like, no one has to have that particular release at another human's, like, I'm going to use the word expense. That's probably not the word that we use. My personal opinion is that, like, I agree. Like, you shouldn't, you know, particularly when, like, you're transactionalizing something. On prescription as well, by the way, like, as a taxpayer. Just pointing that out. separate issue. But, like, you know, maybe there's, like, an argument for, well, robots could help with that type of thing. Because, you know, we're opening up a bigger debate around, like, well, do you need that type of release as a person, like, entirely?
It's about well-being, right? So if you consider another situation where a person is not clinically depressed, therefore does not have depression,
medically speaking,
but has depressive tendencies. Mm-hmm. So once again, not medically depressive, but depressive tendencies. You can still get to be off work for 2 weeks to get some rest by your doctor. Do this person actually need it as much as someone that has depression? Probably not. But this person is still entitled to it without a strong diagnosis. Mm-hmm. So why do a person that is disabled do not have the right to be prescribed something for their mental health and maybe physical health. I'm not a doctor. I cannot tell you about that, but I can talk a bit about mental health. So for me, it is in the same realm, right? I do understand what you mean, but that's another question about, do you agree with prostitution or not? So we're on another topic here. If we consider prostitution to be okay as a basis, okay, for the sake of argument, mm-hmm. because prostitutes, men and female, do agree to this. So they're consenting. We're not talking about labor that is not consented. Okay, so in the ideal world where every person who sells sex is agreeing to it and consenting to all of it, why would it be okay for someone to have a prescription for mental health reasons?
I mean,
you see what I mean?
It's an interesting argument. I mean, like, you know, obviously I'm going to preface this with, well, I'm a disabled person. Like, me being blind doesn't entitle me to get my rocks off, if you'll pardon the expression.
What was this guy's situation?
Honestly, I can't remember that well. Like, obviously, I didn't expect us to go through this time, so I didn't pre-read. But it was someone with a lot of, I think, additional physical needs. But I think the argument was it was on taxpayers' money, so that was a bit of a debate in of itself.
But and there was this
debate around, like, well, like, why are you entitled to another person? Like, and you know, and you mentioning there in the idealized example, everyone is consenting. You can argue that sex workers work, but ultimately the market for that exists, and the fact that market exists is through a system of oppression is another argument to take, and therefore,
well, you know, I agree and disagree with that, because there is people who are willingly being sex workers, right? So I agree with you on the 70% of the people who do not agree to it. This is a fully random number that I shout at. But for the, let's say, 30% that do want to do that as a job, I don't see a problem. And that's also, but that's my opinion about service, and also as a feminist, actually, to say people are entitled, whatever their gender, to do what they want with their body. Mm-hmm. And if it is to have sex and get money out of it, if it's legal, I don't see the problem. And if it's illegal, I think we should consider legality to protect the people who don't do it with consent.
Yeah.
But that's, once again, opinions, 100% personal opinions on this.
No, that, and that's fine. You know, this is, I didn't expect this, like, this tangent, but it's interesting. You know, honestly, like, I kind of sit in that, and that, like, I'm never going to view negatively someone who works in that industry. But, like, you know, I have to question, like, why does the system exist that has left people with, in, you know, we're going to say perhaps the majority of cases, feeling that that is their only avenue of work. That to me, like, as someone left-wing, is like, well, why are there not sustainable jobs for people of all entry levels? Why are people not being educated and skilled and able to have any job they want? And if that is the job they want, fair play.
You know? Exactly. But then we agree, actually. So there you go. We're actually agreeing.
Where the robots fit in?
Exactly. But for me, the robot fit in the fact that everyone is entitled, in my opinion, to the best care possible. I'm being really French on that. Care is free for us. It has been since before I'm born. And for me, everyone should be entitled to the best care for free, or at least for minimum cost. And care, mental health care, can also include sexual relationships. Because if you consider people with physical disabilities, people who lost some abilities as well, imagine someone who had an accident and ended up being paraplegic, right? And need some help with refinding their own body, re-understanding how their body works. In that kind of context, I would 100% see a sex robot as a safe option for them to explore and re-understand how they work. For people with mental health disabilities, and here I'm talking more about people which have a lower IQ, there is in this community a big issue with consent. It is really hard to sometimes know, was it consented or not? And I think maybe teaching them consent through activity with sex robots could actually be a good way as well. You know, making them understand, okay, what is consent? And where does it stop? Where can you say no, which is all the way, but okay. but also teach them to do it. Because I think you never teach as well as when you show and when you make people do. So I'm not saying let's make them have sex with robots. I'm telling them sex robots could be a tool in that kind of therapy and in that kind of teaching.
I mean, another sidebar though, I mean, like, I think like that type of education for everyone would be useful, because I mean, like,
yeah,
I mean, sweet lord, you know, there's a heck of a lot going on in the UK at the moment, but like, just genuinely, that type of education is awful. Like, consent should always be enthusiastic and can be withdrawn at any time, and like, that's just not me speaking as like someone in research. That should just be a human thing, but people don't seem to get that. It's not transactional. But yeah, like,
nope.
Yeah, like, so that, yeah, that's the thing, because I think that type of learning could just be beneficial for many people.
I agree. I just think that there is ways, other ways to teach people that don't have a mental disability. I'm happy to use sex robots with everyone, though, if that's the way to teach, that is the best way. So put everyone in front of a sex robot that says no at some point and see if they stop, and if they don't stop, find a consequence to it. But, you know, that's a bit trivial. So, but that's, I think that's why sex robot would be good. So now there is a new question, where, which is, what about consent of sex robots? And that's a question I've seen pop up a lot, because how can you talk about consent when you talk about sex robots? And I think there is a way. I'm an optimistic human. I think there is a way we could implement that in sex robot. There is a way we could. It's still a product, which means people are still going to buy it for a reason. And as much as some people will want to have, let's say, normative sexual relationships with sex robots, some people might not want that and might want to use it for fantasies. Fantasies that might involve non-consented interaction, right? Intercourse. And that's where the business and the ethics have to discuss to find where we need to sit in the gray area that this is. Because legally, it is an object. It doesn't have to consent. And I don't think there will ever be a law, and maybe I'm wrong, that says robots have to consent to sexual intercourse. So from there, it is an ethical gray area, and we have to discuss it, and we have to find a way where everyone is happy, or at least half happy with it, because that's what consensus is. So, yeah.
Well, fair. I mean, apologies if you listen to this in your kitchen and you disregarded the content warning at the beginning of the show. didn't expect us to go down that tangent, but no, I think it just goes to show the breadth and depth that I think not only robotics, but I mean these ethical questions we have to think about, and we do as a society. And it, in a way, it's kind of good that you brought up like people with their mental and physical disabilities and additional needs, because they're just often an under thought about and represented group.
Yeah.
There's not a lot of people to think about us at all, so then even from like a, this might help with education knowledge or information or any sort of product or service is a really interesting consideration. So let's just, you know, we'll throw away the blueness from this point. Let's talk about your video game research. What's going on with that?
So initially, I did a research on how to change social bias towards group through video games, towards social groups. And it was my master's thesis, actually. Worked out quite well. The sample was small, though, so all scientific people listening to this will know that a small sample means low generalization. Mm-hmm. But I'm still happy with the design. I'm still really happy with what came out of it, because all data were really significant. And so what it shows is that people would change their opinion if they are in the shoes of someone else. So about the group that someone else belongs to.
Before you go any further, just for maybe someone who's not research-minded, could you just explain what you mean by general ability and significance?
Of course, sorry. So significance is when your data actually say something interesting. If they're not significant statistically, then it means, okay, cool, but that is not literally significant. So we don't really care.
It could happen by chance, for example.
Exactly. If it is significant, then you know that there is a link. There is a link there, whether it is causality, whether it is correlation, which are not the same
thing.
As
we always say, correlation doesn't equal causation.
Exactly.
Get that on a t-shirt.
I would need to, I think. I was in a meeting just last Friday, and those people did not get the difference. And it's like, come on. It's not because the cat is sleeping when it rains that the cat sleeps every time it rains. Do you see what I mean? So anyway, that's just a side note and also a bit of an example for people to grasp probably what it means.
The famous one that I always remember is that in summer, the summer months temperature goes up, ice cream sales go up, but so does violent crime. In this example, so it's we can assert then that ice cream sales equal violent crime. Disgusting. And I remember I think that was a first year example, and everyone was like, "But does it though?" And it's no, just because the two numbers happen to go up during the same time doesn't mean that we can say A plus B equals C. That's just
exactly
for anyone. No, but correlation doesn't equal causation. I need that on a t-shirt. But yeah, sorry.
Let's do sweaters. Let's do a full brand with that. I feel like this would sell. There is a market for that.
Master's thesis.
Anyway,
it was significant.
And generalization. We also needed to define generalization. So that's when you can take one result and assess that statistically it is probable that it applies to the entire population. I was at that point looking at my data and was really happy to see that I had some statistical significant results. When you have a link with your character that builds a relationship with your character in a way, with your avatar, and your avatar lives through bad things, lives through emotional things, actually, it will most probably impact you if you're really merged in the game at that point, if you're really being the avatar in a way. And this might change your opinions on the group in which belong your avatar. To give you a really simple example, that is not the one of the thesis, when you play The Walking Dead, the Telltale game, you play a big black man that is tall, that is 40-something years old, that has a past as a criminal, not a big criminal, but a small criminal, went to jail and all that.
I mean, if that isn't a stereotype in of itself, well, that's not.
Exactly. And that's when we get into diversity right after that. And so you play that character and you have more decisions to make throughout the game. And you're gonna, whether this character looks like you or not, it's gonna become you at some point if you're immersed in the game. And probably your visions on big, tall, black guys coming out of jail in their 40s will have changed after playing the game. So that is basically the effect we were looking at. And yeah, that is called cognitive empathy. Empathy is usually linked to emotions, but cognitive empathy is really about just taking someone else's perspective. We're not talking about emotions yet. Mm-hmm. And this seems to work. Once again, small sample. It worked on my small sample. I just hope that we can make the research a bit bigger in the future and see if it works on the big sample. But yeah.
Well, I probably should have said this earlier, but disclosure, Oksana and I actually met through some cyber psychology connections. We've spoken a little bit before, which is how I knew she would be an excellent guest, just saying. That very much kind of taps into the work that I'm doing, centered more around mental health. So it's more of a construct than a character. But the things you're talking about are really important, empathy. I fell down a rabbit hole reading that because that's very philosophical. the elements that it takes and perspective taking and imagining yourself as others and their perceptions. Big, wild, fun times. Not fun times. The role of
I love empathy.
Is I mean, I can't remember the exact categorizations off the top of my head, but there's avatar as me, avatar as other, and the different ways people can perceive their own avatar, things like customization mm-hmm. and narrative design all have an impact on that. You mentioned Telltale. I've played that. I've played all of them. I honestly think season one's probably the best. Season two was all right. But you do really, like, I certainly felt, because of the emotional labor in the narrative, felt very connected to Lee. I felt like Lee was having to deal with these really difficult situations, not having a good time of it, and that element of control of, like, I'm making him make these decisions, you know, that was a very, very deep sort of link. There are other games where, like, you know, you are referred to as you, like, you, the game referred to, it's like, you are making these decisions. There are other games where you might have a customizable avatar, or an avatar that is just, like, a bunch of single-shaded pixels. You know, like, do they, like, are they humanoid? Are they animatronic? Are they just a block of pixels? And then people's connection with those. And that gets onto, like, procedural rhetoric kind of decisions. Like, what does the game allow you to do or not to do? But yeah, I'm on the pulse with that one. I'm looking at that.
Well, that's extremely interesting. And you were mentioning it, the ability to make your avatar do things, the agency. And a big part of this identification process, the process where you and your avatar end up being the same for you during that time you're playing, this is really linked to moral agency. So if you ever played Detroit Become Human or any of the Quantic Dreams or Telltale Studio games or The Life is Strange 1, 2 or 3 that is coming out, soon, well, it just came out actually. Life is Strange 3.
A couple of weeks, I think.
Something I just saw it yesterday on the PSN and I went crazy. So I can't wait to have a weekend to just dedicate to it. But yeah, and so all that, you will have felt it, especially the first time you play a game, the first time you discover the game, because after that, you know, the game, it might happen less. And the game I used for my research was actually Detroit Become Human. And it was the belief I was looking at was trust towards AI technology.
So you can see how the threads linked together there.
Exactly. And I ended up working on robots. So there you go. That was my first step into robots. It's because of Detroit Become Human. 100% because of
them.
There
you go. I mean, you know, we could probably spend the rest of the podcast episode just talking about this. But it is so interesting. I think I read, it might have been, and I might be wrong, but I think it was Dr. Anthony Bean who did the Psychology of Legend of Zelda series. And it was discussion how, like, even, like, Link, who we know is an established character in an established universe, being a silent protagonist who has been made to look, particularly in Breath of the Wild, like, certainly more gender neutral, with the ability to wear whatever outfits you want and customize them whatever colors you want.
Right.
Like, could have, like, a similar effect. Because, like, you want to be Link rolling around Hyrule on a horse, fighting these massive monsters and feeling like the hero, right? That's quintessentially, like, the video game experience.
Right.
But how close do we feel to that? Compared to, and I think I've physically said this to you before, but, like, I'm really annoyed I can't have a character with white hair and Animal Crossings. Genuinely reduces my immersion and my happiness with the game. So, like, even though that's a game centered around me living, well, you can't, well, maybe they've updated it since, but to my knowledge,
I don't know, I don't play Animal Crossing.
At the time of recording, on the latest version of New Horizons, you could not have white hair. So,
wow,
very, very, as a person with albinism, very upsetting for me. So there's kind of like that argument of, even in the universe that's meant to be, you can make your own island, it's you and your animal friends, I can have something like that that, like, really pulls me out of the immersion. But I can still feel like Link throwing boulders at giant monsters. That, like, even though the two, like, roles of the avatar may be different.
Yeah. But also, there might be something about giving you the choice of changing the avatar or not. Because if we give you the choice, then let's give you the actual choice. If we don't give you the choice, then let's not give you the choice.
I went to a talk literally a couple of days ago. I forget where it was, but I heard about it through Dr. Rachel Collett, wonderful, amazing social psychologist in video games.
Yeah,
big fan. She just gonna throw this in. She gonna be in the promo of season two. Called this podcast fantastic. Just saying.
You made it.
That's a thing
that's
said on Twitter. I've peaked. but, like, I went to a talk and it was about gender identity in games, and I remember in I think the game reference was Rust. And people couldn't choose their own avatars. They were just given an avatar. And there were reports of people really kicking off if they were given a character, you know, that was of the opposite gender, or let's be honest, it was mostly like white guys who didn't like playing people of color or women. That's not shoot around.
No way.
That's not beat around the bush. But generally reported that they disliked the game more because they couldn't control their avatar and they didn't want to be. I mean, digital blackfacing and all that kind of is all separate discussion. But I remember that coming up and just being like, wow, like these people dislike playing anyone other than the stereotypical action game guy.
Yeah. No, but that's the kind of stuff that I haven't looked at in detail. So I can't really speak about it as a scientist, but I can speak about it as a gamer. And as a gamer, I'm just pissed at those people, to be fair, because I've had to play the first 7 Assassin's Creed as a male. And I never went after no one for that. So, you know. And in the Assassin's Creed, which one was it? Syndicate was the first one you could be a woman if you wanted to. I could be a woman, that was great, but I had to be sneaky and not strong because, you know,
gender
I was a woman.
Yeah.
And so I would like for all white men to stop whining sometimes. I'm sorry to say that. But yeah, don't want to be rude here, but oh my gosh. And I'm still white. Like, the only thing is that I'm a female. I'm always like figuring out black females. How do they feel about that? Because at least the white people are represented in games.
It's a huge issue. I mean, what do we expect from like an industry that is deeply, deeply troubled at the moment, particularly with its involvement of women in the workplace? And we spoke about that a little bit on the last episode as well, and just how like detrimental that is to people like us as consumers and players, like to realize that these are happening in the places where some of our favorite games are maybe made, let alone with our representation in games. I mean, the diversity is so. It's just bad. It's just bad. There's no other way to say it.
It is terrible.
It's just awful.
It is terrible. But that's exactly. So we get to the research I'm actually on right now in games and diversity. It links perfectly. And so exactly, that's what we figured. We were like, well, we have a really big problem. And the problem is that I am now being represented sometimes. The person I do all those research with usually is Dean McDonald, Dr. Dean McDonald. He was my supervisor during my master's and still a really good working partner now. And he is white and he is represented a lot in games. So we both are more represented than a lot of other people. None of us are disabled and a lot of other categories that we can't tick the box according to, you know, criterion. What about everyone else? It's just unfair. And so we decided to start looking into diversity and how there is none, or really not a lot, in the gaming industry itself. So as you said, it's not just about the games, it's also about who does the game. What are they thinking about? Who, you know, if it's only white males doing the games, well, we might have a bias in there. Maybe.
And let's not get onto like tokenism, because we're not saying these people can't include diverse characters. But as you mentioned with the Assassin's Creed example, it's very often stereotypical and token. Well, you can finally play as a woman. You can't do the action stuff because you picked a woman character. Like, you know.
Yeah. Like, and there is also something I love when I looked. Well, I love. This is satirical, right? This is a cynic comment. I don't actually love it. It's the gay button, as they call it. So the gay button is this thing where if you look really hard for it, you might find one gay character. It applies for all LGBTQ plus, actually. So maybe if you look for it really hard in The Witcher, you have to do a side quest that you like go far enough in this side quest that you meet a hunter. You will go with this hunter for hunt. And after picking the right order for the conversation, you will get to know he is gay. There you go. This is 35 minutes of work to have one gay character in The Witcher.
So, and the game designer's like, they're there. You just didn't find them. Instead of like, you know, and call me radical. but I don't know, like just celebrating like all types of diversity openly and expressively and allowing them to express themselves in a fantasy world where we don't have to tolerate the oppression that we do in the real world. But maybe I'm just a fantasist.
Well, on this, I'm the same kind of utopist. I'm kind of hoping for a game where you don't have to justify or look for that kind of diversity, any kind of diversity, really. That pisses me off a lot. Anyway, so we've decided to make a research out of this, and we're a group of researchers from different universities, majorly based in the UK, actually, looking at that. And hopefully we get a paper out in a few months about exactly that. So what is happening in industry? What is happening to your gamers? What is happening to your culture? And recommendations, because we don't just want to say boo, 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 that's bad. We want to say boo, 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 that's bad. And here is what we offer, which is always better, you know?
Yeah. I mean, I joke. I mean, I know it's just memeing about Animal Crossings and being a person with albinism, but like, I honestly, it's I had fair. This debate with a friend, but I was like trying to think of video game characters that were disabled all, let alone blind, let alone like people with albinism. I mean, honestly, like even in fiction, like, and it's a trope, but like people with albinism are always like the bad guys. Like always, mm-hmm. They're always seen as like a mythical figure. And it relates to, there's a really great episode of History is Sexy on it, on the history of people with albinism. But it just feeds into this greater mythos of like, ooh, look, something that's so obviously different and looks like we can apply religious rhetoric to it.
I was just thinking about Da Vinci Code. Because in Da Vinci Code, the priest that goes around and does the bad stuff is an albino samurai, at least in the book it is.
Mm-hmm. The Invisible Man in the original H.G. Wells novel was a person with albinism.
All right.
The bad guy, the antagonist of the book.
Yeah. I'm trying to see if I know one character in video games or pop culture in general that has albinism and that is not a bad guy. And I can't find one.
I've like racked my brains. I have searched the archives and genuinely very difficult to find. I'm sure it exists. I'm sure someone will let me know in the comments that we've missed a really obvious one. Yeah.
But
it shouldn't be this hard to think about.
Exactly. If we have to think about it for 3 minutes without coming up with something when our topic of research is literally pop culture, I think there is an issue somewhere, because I guess both you and I are a bit of nerds when it comes to comics as well. And you know, all that kind of Marvel, DC, other stuff. So yeah, I'm trying to see if there's an X-Men that has albinism, though. I don't know.
I mean,
probably there must be one X-Men with albinism somewhere that is not a bad guy. That's it. That's what I can come up with.
We live in hope. We live in hope.
Anyway, but yeah, diversity issues. And here's a really good one that you just pointed out. We actually had the same thinking with Dean about people in a wheelchair that do not compensate with being the smartest in the room. Because yes, everyone can argue that Professor Xavier in X-Men is that guy that is, you know, he's in a wheelchair and he's still a hero and he's actually the hero of the heroes. Okay, cool stuff. He's just the smartest guy in the room. He compensates for everything by, oh, yes, but he doesn't need his body. Yeah, how about we change the narrative and we find someone that just is in a wheelchair? You know, just that. Just no but. No yes but, you know?
Yeah, and it's that whole thing of like, and, you know, again, this big spooling discussion. But like, you know, having disabled characters not represented by disabled actors or actresses. You know, the people enacting the profession, like that whole like you're giving us representation but you're not actually representing us. It's that whole like not about us without us kind of movement. Like, you know, I'm speaking to disability, like specifically as a disabled person. You can apply this to basically anything else because it still applies. Like, you know, but it really just is like, why are we not included? Or if we are, it is often tokenistic, like, we gave you a disabled character. It's like never just like, oh, this person happens to be disabled, but it's not a plot point. There's not a special, they don't get their own episode about how difficult it is to be a disabled person. Like, they can just be the character who is like blind or deaf or in a wheelchair. Like, just to three examples off the top of my head. and just that be them as a person.
Yeah. And that links back to also other kind of disabilities, well, other kind of diversities, not disabilities, such as transgenderism. And the big discussion that has been made and hopefully now is closed about having transgender humans playing transgender characters. I remember watching Sense8 for the first time, was it 5 years ago or something like that? Maybe a bit more. And the transgender character in there is actually a transgender actor. Ah, that made me so happy. But that's like one that I can have on the top of my mind. Well, I know that now it's something that's getting more and more kind of normal to do.
And it kind of happens like on accident, because I know like Elliot Page, you know, yeah, has many resuming contracts and stuff that, like, you know, that's up for the writers to make that work and not just sack him, you know.
Yeah.
But like that's, you know, one way that kind of maybe will produce change. But yeah.
Yeah.
So diversity, obviously with all this is rooted in some really awesome stuff, video games and stuff. And as I say,
yeah,
sweet goodness, you're doing some really interesting, very important work. Like,
I hope important. I think we will see once we're done with it. Did it change something?
Are you yourself actually a robot? Is that what this is?
That's exactly what's happening here. I am an android. I've been since day one. But yeah, so hopefully we'll see where all this research leads. I can say it is extremely interesting to work on all those topics and important. We'll see if it has an impact. Hopefully it does.
My opinion would be that it will. I have to believe that it will. Even if you have to kind of like aggressively email the paper to people that need to read it. But, you know, like sending a really aggressive email.
So it was not an aggressive email, but my research on Detroit Become Human, I did send it to the director of the video game, of their video game creation. And we actually chatted about it because he read it. And he was like, wow, this is so interesting. We need more of this. Yes, I know. Welcome to research.
Fund it, please.
Exactly.
You guys give have me the money.
Give me money. I'll do it in 50 countries if you want. No worries at all. I'm happy to do it. Just fund it. But yeah, so there you go. I know that at least from this interaction, that industry would be interested in that kind of research if we were to give it on a golden platter to them. Mm-hmm. And that's where I think we need to find an arrangement.
I was at the IGGI conference. I always forget what the acronym means, but it's a very good sort of school of PhD researchers in game design. And I was there and I said, you know, like, well, as a psychologist, like, you know, we want to work with industry. We want to work with you people developing the games. And they were like, yeah, please do, just keep badgering us, because we're really forgetful about it, because games are, you know, believe this or not, games are like quite difficult to make, just in case you needed to know that.
No way.
Yeah, is I know it? Like, surprise, really? Surprise. The average layperson may not understand just how hard games are to make, but it's a thing. Okay, so I'm gonna try and like steer us away, because we talked a lot about your work, which I can really feel is you're very passionate about, which is awesome. So what do you do when you're not working? You're a gamer, you're into pop culture and stuff. Tell us about that.
Yeah, I'm a nerd. I'm half a nerd, half not, if we can say. I half fit the stereotype, half not, because I will love staying at home for 2 days during my weekends and just read stuff, mm-hmm, play stuff. But I feel extremely guilty about this. So I actually go out as well, and I have a social life. So I love brunch. Brunch is one of my favorite meal of the day.
Oh, brunches. When you can still order like breakfast food and whatever beverage you want. Oh.
Exactly. It's just perfect time. But yeah, and the rest of the time I travel a lot. I am lucky enough to be able to travel and to be able to go see family kind of all around, because as I told you, I'm French, but my dad is German and Greek. So I'm currently in Germany, but we have also my brother in Greece and uncles in Greece. So anyway, that gives me a lot of options to travel, discover new stuff, see my friends, hang out. That's basically most of my free time.
I feel like I have to ask, what's your go-to brunch?
Where or what I get
what,
for
what
brunch?
What do you get for brunch?
What I get? Ooh, Eggs Benedict.
Nice.
That's nice. My favorite. Or avocado toast.
All right, that's...
What do you get for brunch?
I'll be honest, I have like a very fussy palate. It's like my ideal like breakfast slash brunch would be cereal toast and hash browns.
Fair enough, though.
Because I'm very fussy about, like, I do eat meat, but I'm very fussy about the meat that I do eat. Particularly like it's fat content, like the quality of the meat I like sort of as best as possible, kind of like know where it's come from, and I'm very fussy about how I have my bacon. I'm just revealing too much of myself on the podcast now. So like often when I go to brunch, I always end up leaning more towards the lunchtime kind of foods, unless I can just be like, can I have all the toast and all the hash browns, please, thanks.
All right. Fair enough. I think muesli is also a good option, like if you want muesli with fresh fruits and stuff. If you want to get away, keep the breakfast feels going on for brunch, but get away from the meat.
I mean, continental like pastries and breads and stuff. Oh, baked goods are certainly my weakness, like easy.
Of course. But I'm French, which makes me really fussy about that. Because I've eaten croissant in all countries I've lived in, and I've lived in Ireland and Germany outside of France for now, and spent quite a lot of time in Greece as well. And I can tell you, they're bad. There you go. I've said it. It is. No, nothing is as good as a French baker's fresh croissant.
Gonna have
That's
to
it.
Put down controversial in the episode title for this one.
I'm sorry. I had to say it. So that's why here I kind of avoid it unless I'm sure where it comes from. And it's a French bakery. So.
Fair enough. So have you played anything good lately? Read anything good lately? If you've got time.
That's my main issue, isn't it? No, actually, it's fine. This weekend, I didn't play it, but I watched quite a lot of stuff about... what is left of Erin Finch, I think the name of the game is.
Edith Finch.
But that's a game about like a family and they all disappeared and you play a character that goes and find out how all of them disappeared. I want to play that game. Otherwise, I want to play Life is Strange 3, but I need to finish Life is Strange 2 before.
Yeah, Edith Finch is like on my list of like games that really have really strong mental health themes that I want to play, like for research, quote unquote. I'm allowed to say that now. But like I haven't got around to it yet. I'm also aware through like excellent talks by the likes of Dr. Kelly Dunlap that it also has quite a lot of potentially triggering content, and there's maybe not the best amount of warnings and stuff. Like this is something we've spoken about off episode. And that's not great. So, you know, you kind of have to meander around that delicately. If you listen to this and just think about googling it, like just look after yourself.
Be careful with that, because it's talking about different ways people die, and there is a lot of different ways portrayed. Some are accidents and some are not accidents, and that's where I think the biggest risk is. You never see someone actually die, but it is still triggering even for me, and I don't usually have issues with that kind of things. When I play video games, I'm quite resilient. But it touched me, which is also why I want to play that game, because for me, that's interesting that a game puts me in an emotional state. And this had an impact on even people that knew.
So. I love that you like, I find this interesting that it puts me in an emotional state. Like, I've spoken like a true researcher, like a true person that studies psychology, because I feel like anyone else should say, oh, I really like the fact it makes me feel things. Like, and that's completely fine to say, especially when you have that whole, like, video games art is meant to make you feel something. Or if it's entertainment, it's just meant to be entertainment. But, like, no, I agree, and I'm playing Silent Hill 2 at the moment on stream. And I'm doing sort of like I'm just plugging myself, but I'm calling it like a Let's Psychology. I've played it before, but I'm like, let's actually deconstruct some of the psychology that goes into a horror game. Horror games generally represent mental health really poorly, and it's not exempt from that, but it's like a let's go through it and let's dissect it a little bit while also enjoying getting spooked. And I love the sense of tension I feel when I'm wandering about the streets of Silent Hill. Like, it's terrifying.
Fair enough.
But there's part of me that enjoys it, and I don't know why.
It's just... I have an issue with anything horror. So I've watched my first horror movie at 16, which is quite late, I guess, but still. And that's probably, I've watched two horror movies, three in total in my life. One of them was Saw the Seventh, which was just, it's not a horror movie for me. That's just a horrible movie. Yeah, exactly. It's like, why would you do that? I had nightmares about the horrors in there for a really long time. And yeah, I mean, I remember not feeling... Did you see The Village, the movie The Village?
No, but I feel like I heard about it. Like,
they're in a village in the forest, and there is the idea that they can't wear a certain color after certain hours, otherwise monsters will come and eat them. And we were at the end of that movie. That is actually not a horror movie end. It is more of a... I'm not going to spoil it. Well, it's more than 10 years old. I should be allowed to, but I'm not going to do it. But the end is... let's say, not the horrific part of the movie at all. It's actually the good part of the movie. 10 minutes before the end, I was like, I can't take it anymore. I don't want to watch it anymore. And my best friend was like, that's literally it so far. Like, you've done it. I don't want to. And she's like, okay. So actually 5 years later, she put the end for me. And she told me, look, watch, that was 5 years ago what you missed. And I was like, wow, but that's a great end, isn't it? And she's like, yeah, you were just stupid. But anyway, that's how much I hate horror movies and horror stuff. I wish I could play horror games.
It sounds really wild, but like I generally do agree. And I think partly because a lot of the time horror, I was going to say bleeds, but that's a terrible pun, but it ends up going just into gore, and like gore is just a bit icky more than like horrific. Whereas like it sounds like classical stuff, but just stuff that like plays with your mind. Like one of the scariest films I've watched recently was Get Out by Jordan Peele, and like nothing actually that horrific like really happens. It's not jump scares, but the sense of tension, I have not felt like as physically ill or as physically tense. And I watched that like in two parts with one of my friends. And like first half, we were watching like, oh yeah, you know, no spoilers, because go and watch Get Out because it's fantastic. But then like finishes, and you're like, whoa, that's a big statement, that's a big commentary. Wow, big film, amazing, 10 out of 10. Like,
fair enough. It reminds me of Panic Room. Do you know if you've seen that movie? That was also like, 15 years ago or something.
That's like 2003. That's an oldie.
Yeah, but I remember that movie because it's the same. I was tense throughout the entire thing, but in the end you're just like, and I feel like that's a real psychological thriller, right? That's how they call it now. But that, I love psychological thrillers, even though it puts you on your toes and you're kind of not ready for whatever's gonna happen next. I really like it. So maybe Silent Hill is more like that than, how is it?
It definitely, Silent Hill 2 specifically, because I'll put my hands up, that's the only one I've played. But like, it does just like, put it this way, like every time you go through and it's a loading screen, like I'm ready for anything. And it might not be anything, it might just be an empty room. Okay. But the fact that it makes me feel so like on edge is like the kind of thing that is exciting. As well as, you know, the metaphor and the sort of more like, oh yeah, well, you're forced into tight, closed spaces, and you know, the noise from the thing that alerts you about the monsters attracts the monsters, as does your flashlight, but you need both to survive. That kind of like operating within the give and take of trying to get yourself through the game and survive, get out, figure out the mysteries, no spoilers, and also like not wanting to walk around the corner because you know there's a big scary thing there.
Well, I kind of want to watch you play now. I couldn't play it myself, but I love going on Twitch and just watch people play. And I'm like, oh, wow, I could not do that. And that's my entire narrative throughout everyone playing, you know.
I'll put it this way. The biggest jump I had was when one of my viewers just used a normal sound command. It's not even a scary sound command. It's a clip from a game called Little Misfortune that just says, fancy. But it just came out of nowhere and I actually jumped out my skin. And I was
Why would you give that power to anyone when you're playing that kind of game? Don't do it.
Because it was just meant, like, I just left them on because they're usually just things that people will put in chat during just other moments. And if it was innocuous, it was not even scary, but I nearly died. It's clipped on the channel. Not just plugging myself, it is clipped, but you can just watch me. I physically jump out my skin and I'm like, dang it, Bob, why are you doing this to me? Like, great fun, good times.
Look at that.
Sorry, I feel like this has been like really intense moral discussion and then me plugging myself.
No, but that's perfect. I love it. It's a discussion now. That's perfect.
So yeah, next couple of questions. These are a bit more blue sky. Like, what's the very next thing sort of coming up for your work? If you want to let people know that. Obviously, you're doing a lot.
The very next thing is me sitting at a desk and writing stuff down instead of just researching stuff.
Wait, you have to write things? Oh, wow.
I know. Not sure about that. I know. I know. I tried to get out of it, but they told me master students can't write for you. So there you go. I tried it all. It's jokes aside, there's that. But you also can find two of the research briefs, which are basically white papers that we write on different topics that I've written for the institute I work for. So if you Google my name, you should find it.
I'll attach a link to the description to the episode.
Amazing. One is on social robots. So if anyone is interested in the topic, it is a brief overview. I try to do my best to give keys to everyone interested in the topic to start getting into it. It's 9 pages and it's not really fun. I'm sorry about that. It is a really serious thing about risks of social robots and opportunities. So yeah. And in the future, there will just be more of that, hopefully.
Awesome. This is one of my favorite sort of couple of questions now. The first one is blue sky. If you had no limitations at all, what would you like to research? I always give this as an example. Mine would be Celeste. I'd get people to play it. I would charter their response to it. It has brilliant mental health themes. It is arguably one of the best games in existence, period. I will die on that hill. And the soundtrack is wall-to-wall banger. That's mine. Longitudinal study, right. Access to the data, get to interview people, just capturing lots of data. You've got infinite resources, people, money, like anything. What would you like to research?
Okay, so no limitation.
No.
I would love to keep with the social robots, but actually do a longitudinal experiment with social robots in homes, with children, with adults, with older generation, every type of population you can think of. Physically disabled people or not, and try to figure out the best way after on a 3 years longitudinal study with over 200 participants, you know, something that just doesn't happen. And then try to figure out, okay, what is it they need? What is the need of a specific population? How do we make it better and safe for everyone?
Nice.
That's my nice. Favorite. Maybe someday if I'm rich, research.
You've got to have the blue sky ones, right? Because I think everyone I've asked that question, they give this wonderful blue sky answer and they're like, the building blocks are kind of there and the other work they're doing. So maybe the blue sky research project isn't a research project we do, but it's a research project we work around.
And then maybe 10 years from now, I'll say, hey, if I put everything together, it kind of looks like it. It's a bit of Frankenstein, but yeah.
Okay.
Hopefully.
So second sort of last question before we get to the quick fire ones. I would like to ask, do you have anyone or anything that inspires you that you would like to give mention to? Obviously, you can be inspired by multiple things, multiple people, but is there one that you'd care to mention or sort of inform our listeners about?
So inspirations, there's quite a few of those. There is the everyday inspirations, which are two of the people working with me, or for who I work for, actually. One is our executive director, Dr. Caitlin Corrigan. She is just a rock star. And the other one is Nalini, which is another professor I work with, and same, she's a rock star. But then you have also the kind of bigger scale inspirations. Actually, funny enough, Linda Kay was one of those and still is one of those.
Previous guest on the show, episode...
Exactly.
Oh, I can't remember the number. Previous episode.
Exactly. And then if you go even bigger and bigger, you get to Michelle Obama. That's the kind of people, Marie Curie. You know, that's just... the biggest inspirations, the one that are up there that you look at and you're like, okay, well, those people made it, right? Mm-hmm. And they made it while being kind. And I think that's my biggest inspiration.
Nice. That's really good. I also do want to just sort of plug a little bit and just dial back. But you mentioned you were doing a PhD. Like, what, you know, I'm doing one. What's your PhD sort of journey feeling like as an individual?
I'm lucky. That's basically my global feeling about my PhD, is that I'm lucky to do a topic that not a lot of people would have let me do, right? Because I picked my topic. I came in and I said, I want to do that. And someone said, yes, sure, here is money, do it. And that is, I think, the first step of being happy when you do a PhD, is that you pick your topic. On top of that, I am financed. My supervisor is an amazing guy. He's extremely supportive. He's also a really big name and all that, but regardless, that's not really the point, is that as a supervisor, I do appreciate him a lot. And I'm surrounded by amazing people. So there is a lot to do. There is a lot of stress, especially coming with the site quests that we were mentioning earlier. A lot of deadlines, a lot of you have to do things, but at the same time, I'm choosing to do the site quests. No one came and said you have to do it. So that's also the freedom and the cost of freedom, if we can say. So yeah, I feel like I'm lucky. I'm not sure I see the end of my PhD. I'm not sure I'll see it ever. Every morning I'm asking myself, why? You have a master's. You could just go and work and you would have a decent life. But I think I wouldn't be happy. So here
it's
I
funny,
am trying
It's funny
to...
you say that. Someone on Twitter was like, oh, you know, we're talking about, I think it was pre-registration. And I sort of chipped in my 2 pence worth. And I was like, oh, you know. And you're like, I'll just kind of want to get my head around it in case I ever do a PhD. And I was like, on a PhD, definitely do it. / dear Lord, don't do it.
Yeah, exactly. It's the best and the worst at the same time. If you're lucky enough to have a sane environment, because I guess, how do you feel about your PhD?
I mean, like,
I think we're kind of on the same.
I was just going to say the same thing. Like, some days it's like, oh goodness, what am I going to do? How I'm never going to finish this. And then like on the other side, I'm like, I'm technically getting paid to play video games and test them for science. I have to do some teaching and stuff, which is a little bit scary, but like,
come on,
yeah,
you'll do great.
I mean, video games and science, that's the dream, right? That's, you know, that kind of like, don't question, if you don't question it, no one can ever turn around and go, no, you're not allowed to do that kind of thing, you know? Like,
yeah,
you won't wake up if you don't realize it's a dream.
That's kind of it. But yeah, I think the main thing with the PhD is that it's, if you're happy more than 50% of the time, you won. Because I've read horror stories about PhD, and that scared me out at some point. And I was like, wow, is my supervisor going to reveal himself as being an abusive person? Guess what? He didn't. And probably never will, because I don't think that's who he is. So there is a lot of things like that where that could go wrong. You know, your fundings are going to be suspended. Well, actually, I'm employed. So no, I won't, as long as I have a contract, you know. But it's just that kind of things where you
well, I mean,
hear
you know, you've,
horror
you've
stories.
Been doing this through, like, I mean, COVID, you know. I mean, unfortunately, yeah. These horror stories exist because they did happen. People sometimes do reveal themselves to be unsavory characters, shall we say. It does happen.
Yeah.
These things exist, and it's unfortunate and really terrible that these things do happen. But I think, yeah, that like the reverse of that is that, like, you kind of have to, on like, I'm going to say our part, if you'll permit me to do so, like, really lucky to say that that's not the case at this point for ourselves.
Yeah.
And count those blessings, if you will.
Exactly. So that's what I do every time. I'm like, why am I doing this? I'm like, hey, yes, that doesn't answer why, but you can do it. There you go. That's it. That's because you're allowed and you have the support for it.
Yeah.
So
awesome.
Still don't know why. Still don't know where I'm finishing. Still not seeing the end of that tunnel, but loving it. So everything's good.
Awesome. Okay, so I always like to wrap up these with a little quick fire section. So I always preface with that you're going away on a retreat. You're optionally going. You're not being forced. It's not a deserted island. It can be whatever type of landscape you like. It can be a cabin in the woods, a meadow, whatever. But you are only allowed to take a limited number of things with you. So like one film or TV show box set, an album, a book, or sort of, you know, if it's sold as a physical box set, I'll give you the box set. And a video game. What do you take with you? You're allowed one of each.
So, am I allowed one movie and one TV show, or am I allowed only just one of those?
Either or.
Okay.
Or both.
Okay. So I'll go with Stargate SG-1, the TV show. As a TV show. Then as a book, I will go with Captain Corelli's Mandoline, which is an amazing book. You said then an album.
Mm-hmm.
For an album, I'll go with I'm Not Dead, Pink.
Nice.
It's just loving Pink. Got to. And what was the last thing?
Video game.
Oh, a video game. Oh, wow. Life is Strange 3, because I haven't played it yet, and then I'll have the time.
I'm applauding that, because no one has given me that bold an answer yet. Anyone who said that, they've always gone like, okay, my favorite game, a game with infinite replayability. And you're just like, no, the one I really want to play most, like right now.
Yeah, exactly. I've been dreaming of it for so many months to have the time to just sit down and finish Life is Strange 2 and actually do Life is Strange 3 when it comes out.
I'm conscious of your time, and I'm very respectful you spent a long time with me already. But
it's my pleasure.
We've spoken about my opinions of Life is Strange. Let's not get into that. I haven't played the second one, the prequel. When the third one came out, like, you know, was first announced, there were a few ripples in like the communities I'm in of like, oh, empathy is a superpower. Like, oh, that the representation of this could be a bit yikes, because if so, every therapist is, you know, a superhero, yeah. And medical staff are superheroes because they all employ empathy. So like, oddly enough, I feel like I haven't heard much chatter afterwards. I've heard people generally say it's got good reviews, but I haven't had the chance to deep dive for like that type of analysis. What are your kind of expecting from it? What are you sort of hoping for?
So there is a rule, is that when I play a video game not for research, I will put my brain aside. So that means that empathy being a superpower, you know what? I'll go with it. Who cares? I'm not going to think about the rationale behind that. It's a video game. This is a utopian world where I don't have to care about those stuff. Now, what I've seen is that they've added a layer kind of to the narrative that is now it's an investigation that you're doing. So I'm actually excited about Heavy Rain meets Life is Strange kind of situation. You know what I mean? I'm kind of hoping for something like that. Maybe I'll be disappointed, but it is an investigation. You got to find clues. I kind of want to see something a bit more free, gameplay wise than the usual Life is Strange, but we'll see. We'll see. But I'm hoping for something good. I'm hoping to get into the story like I was for Heavy Rain, and just be stuck in there for like however long it takes, probably 20 hours or something.
Okay, I'll tell you what, I'll throw down the gauntlet. I'll go away and play Detroit Being Human. You go away and play True Colors, and we'll get back and do a little mini bonus episode of us reviewing them.
Let's do that. So True Colors it is. I'm noting it down there.
Can you
play on PS4?
Yes. I'll give Detroit Being Human a go. Because several, it's another game that's in the list. People said this is really interesting.
It poses
really interesting questions, and it's my like. I like narrative games. I'm a big fan of them, so I just haven't got around to playing it.
And I mean, come on, robots! That is so cool. That's like my two favorite topics in one place.
Fair.
It's the best game.
Okay. The very last thing that I want to ask you before we wrap up is there anything that you want to ask me? I will warn you. I will warn you. I've been asked what are your picks twice already.
Oh, I'm not going to ask that. I was going to ask, how are you?
How am
in
I?
In general.
Yeah,
what's up?
Oh, gosh.
What's your life like? What's up with you?
I was unprepared for this question. So at the time of recording, it's checks calendar, Monday, October 4th, 2021. So for me to sort of time capsule myself a little bit, I'm now 10 months into my own PhD, I'll be a second year before I know it. I've been fully ethically approved. I'm hoping to get all my surveys approved by my supervisors and then pre-registration done, hopefully within the next week or two, and then data collection for my first empirical study.
Yay!
Big yikes. First teaching session is this week. So like by the time you will have heard this out, not on early access, it'll be like a few days afterwards. So, you know, check the stream. You'll probably hear my reaction and reviewing my teaching experience. Check that out. Yeah, so like scared but excited. There's like a new intake of PhDs coming in the uni. So like it's going to be great to meet some new people. A couple of people I've like spoken to beforehand. But yeah, it's just like we're in October already. Where did the year go? Yeah. I'm like, I feel like it's that meme, but like it's a guy blinking. It's like he's got his eyes open. It's 2019, blinks, and it's 2021. It's like that, and I'm like, it's October. Like, where did it go?
Yeah.
Like.
Okay, good. Some positive stuff.
Yeah, like okay, but good. Like, am I doing too many side quests? Who knows? I'm not going to question it. I'm just going to keep going.
Exactly. Until you actually don't have the time to do one, I feel like it's fine.
Yeah,
maybe.
Like, you know, not taking on too many others, but like definitely be like, oh, I have the capacity for these ones.
Exactly. And about the teaching, you're going to do great. Look, you're talking to people all the time on your streams and all. So I know that's something that can be a bit scary, but I swear students are nice.
I'll just pretend. So. That's it. I'll just pretend I'm on Twitch. I'll just pretend they're all on the
exactly
watching me.
And worst case scenario, you can be snarky. You can make snarky comments about anything and they'll just be happy and laugh with you, you know? Except if they don't understand it, and then they just don't deserve your snarky comments. There you go.
Right, well, Oksan, absolutely pleasure to have you on the show. I've really enjoyed it.
Thank you.
All the links to catch up with Oksan will be attached to wherever you found this episode, including those papers that she mentioned, the recommendations, and obviously her Twitter. You're fairly active on Twitter.
Yeah, I am. And also, just if anyone is interested in working in social robotics, techie or non-techie or psychological wise, just reach out because I'm trying to find some people who would want to work on this topic from an ethical standpoint and especially a psychological standpoint. We're two, okay? At the moment that I know of, we're two. So,
I mean, so if you're listening, your peeps got to be out there somewhere.
Exactly.
They'll exist. Right, all that remains for me to do is to, for our visual viewers, just move over to the ending screen when I can find it. Thank you everyone so much for listening. I really appreciate it, and we will catch you again very soon. But until then, look after your mind, body, and soul. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Well, thank you so much for listening to another episode of Psyched to Be With You. I really hope you enjoyed it as much as I did. As ever, if you did enjoy it, please leave a review wherever you listen to your podcasts. It really, really helps. If you want to keep up with all things Blind Psyche, check out the episode description for a link, or you can go direct to linktr.ee/blindpsyche. Thank you so much for listening. As ever, look after your mind, body, and soul, and I will see you again very, very soon. Bye-bye.